Welcome to Exec Insights, conversations about Australian business and the changing world. I'm Kate Joiner from QUT's Graduate School of Business, and today my guest is a colleague in the Graduate School, Dr. Rachel Collis. Rachel teaches negotiation skills on the Executive MBA and MBA programs. Rachel has had a full, interesting and varied career. Prior to ranging into corporate coaching and training, Rachel was a doctor and gained 15 years experience as a consultant psychiatrist. So, Rachel, consultant psychiatrist sounds like an interesting place from which to launch an interest in negotiation, really. I can see how that would come in handy. Do you find that?
Absolutely, yes. The kind of first negotiations I did were as a junior doctor on psychiatric wards. Mm. And they were mainly about stopping people killing themselves, killing other people and killing me was where I kind of learnt my skills. And I would say I mainly learned those skills from some very experienced nurses who'd been around and knew how to do that really well.
So that's really negotiating in when the stakes are really high.
Really
right?
High, yeah, mm. Yeah. And so, but actually, when you come down to it, it's the same, that the skills are the same of trying to understand the other person's perspective and trying to build trust and trying to get them to talk to you about what really matters to them.
Yeah, before we get into the nuts and bolts of negotiating, which I'm really interested to hear about. So I know you've actually got an associated interest in career and career management. So your own career is actually quite varied. So one would wonder how you move from background in medicine and psychiatry. To where you are now. So with that interest in leadership and so forth. So I guess in one hop, it sounds like a real change, but I suppose it happened gradually. Is that right? Did you have a real intention or did it?
So no. So I had an intention to leave psychiatry. I got really burnt out. Psychiatry's hard. And what I did looking back now is a thing that you call a night's moving career, which is you move somewhere that's kind of logical next and then from that somewhere logical next and then end up in a third space that is really a long way from your first place. And so the first place I moved into was mediation training. I trained as a mediator and I started off doing a lot of workplace mediations where one member of a group was living with some sort of mental illness that was making it hard for them to interact with other people, was where I kind of started. And then that kind of morphed out into all sorts of workplace mediations and then kind of team facilitation. And then from there, I started to see that the people I was working with, that the answers to a lot of their problems were actually in the leadership and management literature. So I became very, very interested in that and started to learn that. And so then moved into executive coaching and then gradually built a relationship with QUT and ended up teaching negotiation skills on the Executive MBA program, which I love.
So it's that crossover between negotiation, psychiatry and leadership?
Yeah, kind of gradually, kind of bit by bit, moving from one thing to another thing. Yeah.
So what interested you, or what kind of solutions were you looking for in the leadership literature? I guess I'm interested in that because I kind of think the leadership literature is kind of theoretical in a way.
Yeah, well, the problems I saw, particularly as a mediator, were people not enjoying their work, people not having enough direction, so they didn't know what they were supposed to be achieving and not kind of feeling rewarded when they did achieve it, people feeling disconnected to other people in their team.
Just a standard day at work, right?
Yeah, exactly. All of the kind of stuff that we work on when we try and help people be better leaders and managers, that those skills of helping, creating coherent teams and helping people be effective are what makes people then get upset and fall out.
So it's actually a more systemic look. Yeah. So trying to dissolve the problem that requires mediation rather than solving the...
Yes, actually get underneath, well, what is going on, rather than actually coming up with a patch solution. Actually, well, what is going on here in this team that we could actually change? I got very interested in that.
Yeah, so as not to need so much mediation service.
Yes.
Yeah, I can get with that. So we'll get into negotiation, the kinds of things that you might share with MBA students, for example, in our number one EMBA program in the
Woo-hoo.
Country. I'd say this is a podcast without advertisement, really. But I'll throw in a plug. We are the number one EMBA in the country. Yay us. But so the kinds of things we might look at with our students. So I was told to ask you your story about buying your car. And you had perhaps a very elaborate spreadsheet, which exemplified the use of what we might call a BATNA, which is a best alternative to a negotiated solution, as outcome. BATNA, what's A for BATNA?
Best alternative to a negotiated agreement.
Agreement.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I, like a lot of people, had to buy a new car. And of course, I am a negotiator. That's my thing. And
so if you can't get the best price on a car,
exactly, then it's, you know, my career is hanging on the line. Can I do this properly? It's quite stressful. And what made it even more stressful was the sales rep, in the way that they do, said, "And what do you do?" And I actually honestly told him I teach negotiation on the MBA program. He's like, "Oh, okay."
Yes, so you know all my tricks.
Yes, that's right. So we kind of, but I think he thought that then that would mean I would be kind of tough and mean to him. And of course, it was the opposite, that the basis of good negotiation is doing lots of preparation. And so that involved finding out what the best price was for the car I wanted. And I shouldn't do a plug, but I do. There's a website called AutoGenie in Australia that you can spend $49 and say, "This is the car I want." And they'll give you at least three offers from dealerships around Australia.
Which would cut down the salesman's repertoire,
yes,
quite considerably.
Absolutely.
Imagine.
So you go in and you've got, you know, three really good offers. So that's your BATNA, that if this person in front of me can't do a better offer than that, then I'm going to buy the car off the web. Easy. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is a mistake people make in negotiations is that there's a lot of data to hold in their head. And so they try and hold it in their head and then they get befuddled and confused and so make a decision that isn't the right decision for them. So I made a spreadsheet of the various, you know, items that I might want and what the cost was of them. And as he was putting together various deals, I ran it through the spreadsheet on my iPad in front of him. And this poor fellow said, "What are you doing on your iPad then?" I said, "I've just got a spreadsheet, I'm just running the numbers." And this fellow was in his 50s, he'd been a sales rep all of his life. He said, "I've never seen anybody do that," which I found astounding because I don't understand how anybody could manage
so
to.
So he's just sort of doing an arbitrage out of complexity, you know.
Yeah.
So that's where the value can be added from his perspective, that we're all befuddled by complexity.
Yes, that we're befuddled and so therefore we miss the fact that they've offered me something that's really only worth $30 but made me think it's something big. Whereas, you know, if you've got the numbers, you can sit and
but
do
you're
it.
Staying in the rational space.
Yes, and you can keep on checking back and it gives you space. But you have to be quite determined to do that because, of course, yeah, that's not in their interest for you to make this very logical, rational decision. But I did, and I bought the car. But of course, the tricky thing about negotiation is I can never really know whether they would have done a better deal for me or not, you know.
There still has to be some art to it.
Yes, exactly. Mm. So I did my best, and who knows, but I'm very pleased with the car.
I've already learned a lot from that because I'm actually in the car
market
for a car. Or I'm thinking I am because I haven't got a car, it died. Now I'm in that space, do I wait for this world where we don't have to drive a car? I'm thinking, is it here now? Am I in it?
Exactly. It's tricky.
If I didn't have to, boy, I so wouldn't. But anyway, that's the point that negotiating on the sale price of a car, which is like a classic negotiation, that's the kind of skill we associate with negotiations, like getting the best possible outcome for yourself,
yes,
and extracting the most amount of concession from the other party. So it's like a two-party, one-shot situation. And you'll never have to see that car salesman again, so you don't have to kind of build a relationship. But of course, in organisational life, it's what we have to deal with is a lot richer and more complex than that. So often if we're in government, it's a policy that requires stakeholder engagement on wide ranging. If we're in the private sector, it might be a huge construction project. Again, many stakeholders, many variables, lots of complexity that we hopefully don't keep in our head. But what changes from the kind of car dealership negotiation to something that's a little bit richer, more moving parts?
So there's a lot there, Kate. And you're exactly right that most negotiations that leaders do are highly complex. And often there may be numbers in it, but often it's the things other than the numbers that matter a lot. And in those kind of negotiations, building trust and maintaining trust, and doing a deal that the person will still think is a good deal 6 months later is really important, because if you've got an ongoing relationship with somebody and they realise you've done them over, they either won't negotiate with you again, or if they do, they're going to be really tough to negotiate.
So that's like the repeated game exercise in like game
theory.
Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so all of a sudden we have to start thinking about their needs and their wants and how we can create these integrative solutions where I try and work out if I can give you something that really matters to you that actually doesn't matter to me and vice versa.
So that was, in preparation for this podcast interview, you sent me a Harvard Business Review outcome about 6 mistakes.
Yes.
So actually, mistake number one was neglecting the other side's problem. So only going in with our own worldview and our own understanding about our own interests, where negotiation one-on-one is starting with them and putting yourself in their headspace. And I think it's about focusing on interests rather than
positions.
Yes. Yeah. Is that a classic mistake people make, or what you?
Yeah. Both of those. So, the problem with the perspective taking piece of actually kind of pouring yourself into the other person's perspective is it's really hard. That particularly if it's an emotional negotiation, we kind of get very attached to our own view and that we're right, and that the other person's wrong, and so actually kind of trying to think about the ways that they might be right and the ways how the world is viewed from their place is incredibly hard and sometimes quite uncomfortable. And so it's easy for us to avoid that. And so that's a really hard piece. And the other piece that you mentioned is the shift from positions to interests. So if the position is the thing I say I want $1 million. But the interest is, well, why do I want that? Why is that important to me? What am I going to use that for? And that matters because once we can get into those underlying interests, we can start to be more creative. So if I want $1 million because I want to give up work, then that's a different thing to if I want $1 million so I can buy a house and pay my kids' school fees. And so once we actually get into those deeper things, we can be much more creative in our problem solving and kind of look at, well, what does this person really want? What do I really want? And how can we work out how we can both give each other what we want.
What we want, yeah. So I'm thinking too, in some of the examples that I was reading in the HBR article and speaking with you, it's about, I think those of us who have to negotiate or work with, you know, multi-stakeholder policy, it does require a level of, I'll say emotional intelligence, one could also say grown-upness.
Yes, that's right.
You know, grown-upness meaning that we can't be driven by our ego, I think, or wanting to feel that we need to win in all circumstances. And that can be, in my experience, I still do quite a lot of work with partnering, you know, partnering workshops of all kinds. And the need to win and to kill the person across the other table is still the default, I find.
Yes. There is a great theory that I'm probably going to misquote called something like the argumentative theory of reasoning or something, that says that the default position of humans when they're having a discussion is not to get to the truth, but it's to win. Mm-hmm. And that comes back because for most of our history, we were living in these small groups, and what we needed to do was become the dominant ape or the dominant person in the troop. And so winning mattered. The truth didn't matter very much. It was winning. And so there's this kind of deep thing in our default. They're French cognitive psychologists who have this theory that actually this is a default position for humans to just want to win, and that we claim we're interested in the truth, but we find that intensely difficult to actually kind of sit with. What I want to know is, what's really true here and what's true for you, and kind of where's the messy place in the middle of the truth? Mm. We just want to win.
We just want to win. And often this is where we get to, and I think it's about human rationality. So we know that Richard Thaler won the Nobel Prize this week for his work on behavioural economics. So we know that human beings aren't always driven by rationality. So it's like, it's classic in a divorce, for example, that you would rather come away with nothing than to see that other person come away with more than you. You know, you'd rather just tip the whole bowl of everything out rather than see that person get more than you. So we're driven, you know, just by basic human drives, aren't we, for the most part.
There's a wonderful video that I encourage people to Google about the cucumber grape monkey study, which I show my students, which has this delightful thing of two monkeys who have to do a task, which is give a researcher a rock, and they can see each other, but they can't touch each other. And the researcher gives one monkey a piece of cucumber in exchange for the rock, and the other monkey gets a grape in exchange for the rock. And when it starts, the first monkey gets his cucumber and he's like, fine, I've given you a piece of rock and I've got a cucumber, I'm happy. Then the monkey sees the other one get the grape and this monkey goes crazy and he won't accept the cucumber. He starts hurling the cucumber at the researcher and banging and sort of thing. And the researcher who talks about this says, you know, here's the Wall Street protest, that we would rather hurl our cucumber at somebody if we feel things are unequal and have nothing than actually be the person with the cucumber when you have got the grape, because it's not fair. And so this kind of primitive desire to achieve equality and fairness is so deep.
So deep, yeah. What is that? I remember a colleague of mine, we had to distribute a superannuation surplus funds, you know, and he said, no, I'm sorry, I won't accept this. This my superannuation, and you know, I said, hey, like, you have to accept it, it's your money. No, because if I accept it, I'll have to give some to my wife in the divorce settlement, and I would rather have nothing than give her anything.
Absolutely, you know? Yes.
Yes.
We're not rational beings.
No, we're not rational in a lot of ways too. So, I mean, that mistake number 6 in the Harvard Business Review about failing to correct for skewed vision. Yeah. So not checking, you know, we've got a self-serving bias. And checking biases of all kinds, you know, is something, and an ability for our brain to deal with complexity. So we've got bounded rationality, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess there's some techniques, like your spreadsheet was a technique to get around the complexity what that does to our brain. Yeah. And I'm assuming there's some other ways that we can correct for our own biases.
Yeah, but biases are interesting because some of them, just knowing about them helps, that being aware of, say, egocentrism, that you see the world through your eyes. And so you know every single time that you take the bin out, but you only perhaps notice 30% of the time that your partner takes the bin out. So therefore it feels like you always take the bin out. That we can kind of, if we remind ourselves of that, kind of helps. But there's some cognitive biases like anchoring, which is where if you get given a number, any random number, and then asked to give a price for something, that the size of the number you were given beforehand actually has an impact on the number that you offer. Car sales people use this because they have a price on the car that then anchors as, this is the price that we've got to pay. And even knowing about anchoring apparently doesn't protect us from it. We're still impacted on it. And so this is where doing things like doing lots of research to find what you think is a reasonable price for a car, and having a spreadsheet and putting all sorts of checks and balances in place to kind of manage your failings as a human and the failings of your human mind, and recognising that you have,
And perhaps recognising too, I mean, I fully recognise that I'm not a great negotiator, and I because I feel that my interests are not worth fighting for, you know, I'm refrain from saying that's a female thing.
Sadly it is, Kate.
Okay, thank you.
So what it looks like, there is some research that suggests that women are probably better negotiators than men when they are negotiating on the behalf of other people. But when they're negotiating for themselves, they're worse. And because of this thing that women are socialised to not ask for what they need. And if you look at it, women actually it's definitely getting better, women get punished when they actually ask for what they need. So a woman who tries to negotiate her salary will be seen as aggressive, whereas a man who tries to negotiate his salary will be seen as assertive. I think that's changing. The sense I get is that is changing, but I think it's a thing that is a problem that we need to be aware
and
of.
And I guess if I put my rational brain on, it would say, well, perhaps in the business of buying a car, which I may well soon, it may be better just to send in a proxy to do all the negotiating for me if I'm not capable of negotiating for myself because of built-in whatever's pre-programmed narratives or scripts in my brain. Just getting somebody else to do it is probably a good idea.
And the other suggestion that Margaret Neal makes, Margaret Neal did, she's a thought leader in negotiation, and she did some stuff for the Lean In Project. Mm-hmm. And her suggestion for women for this is to think about who else you are kind of negotiating on behalf of. So she said, I mean, this is an interesting, she said when she's negotiating her salary package, she thinks about her horses and how she wants to spend time with her horses, and her horses are expensive, so she's negotiating on behalf of her horses. And so to kind of think about that when you're doing these negotiations, although it feels like it's for you, it is actually for lots of other stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And so to kind of bring them into the room can help you to be more assertive.
That is so true. Yes. And I think that's what I did on my last.
Kind of position yourself.
To kind of rise, make yourself rise up and do it. Yeah. So negotiating is still a really key skill, which is why we teach it in our MBA program. So it's kind of fundamental to most business practice. Would you agree?
Oh, 100%. And I've just finished teaching the MBA cohort. I was teaching them this weekend. And that was the thing that they come up to me kind of after about kind of the second workshop. They come and say, oh, Rachel, I didn't realise this is a fundamental leadership skill. We're doing this all the time, aren't we? All the time. We're constantly negotiating with people. And it's such an important skill. So, yeah, I am really passionate that if we can help leaders to be better negotiators, we help them to be better leaders and the world gets better.
I would agree. And I'm going to finish on. I haven't prepped you for this, so if we have to take our time, we will. What are you reading at the moment? What's interesting?
Oh, I am reading Radical Candor by Kim Scott, which is a wonderful book. Kim Scott worked for Google, for Sheryl Sandberg, and also she's worked in Apple. She's a great book. And she also got offered the position of CEO of Twitter, but she didn't take it because she just had twins. So she's an impressive woman. And this book is about the importance of us being radically candid, which is, she says, as leaders, being really honest and being really willing to give people, honest and courageous feedback. But she said that has to be in a context where we repeatedly demonstrate A, deep care for the other person, and B, that we are willing to take the feedback. And it's a delightful book about leadership. I'm really enjoying
it. Both things really hard.
Yes, exactly. Really, really.
Yeah. None of this is easy.
No, exactly. And so she takes quite a lot of time, talking it through. And it's a lovely book because she talks quite often about the ways in which she failed. It's not a, I'm so marvellous book. It's, I did this thing where I just, refused to take a piece of feedback and then expected somebody else to take feedback or some sort of thing like that. And it's, I recommend it. Any leaders.
Thank you for that tip. And Rachel Collis, it's been a while in the negotiating to get you here, but obviously my negotiating skills were good enough to get you here. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's been lovely to talk with you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Exec Insights. For more information about QUT's executive education programs, please search QUT Executive Education and you'll find a full range of our programs and services.